and welcome to Podcast 130. I'm Chris Shuck, and joined with me as usual is Dan Roth. Dan, what's up?
Good evening.
And Sam Abula Salmon. What's going on, Sam?
Oh, I'm getting pounded by this pollen. It's ugly.
Okay. Very descriptive way to talk about allergies, but all right. Let's talk about, we got plenty, obviously, again, to talk about with the GM bankruptcy and all that surrounds that. Quite a few stories involved there. But first, we'll start, as usual, with the Autoblock Garage. Dan, what do you have?
I still have the Volkswagen CC. I've had a week with it now, and I can say that...
How's the DSG working?
It's not the DSG. I thought initially it was because it had paddles, and it paused a lot between park and drive and stuff. It's just a regular automatic.
It's a regular Tiptronic?
Yeah, but I still stand by the opinion that the car is not fully realized for the promises that it makes. It's very stylish, which makes it a little less than practical because of that roofline. The seats are pretty comfortable, but after a while, I just wanted to get out of it. I drove it a lot, so... And it's nice, but it doesn't ride as well as I think it should, and it doesn't perform as well as it might if it's going to ride the way it does. So, there you go.
All right. Well, Sam, what do you have this week?
Just traded in the Jetta TDI Sport Wagon for an Audi A3 2.0T Quattro with S-Line package and S-Tronic, which came out to a fairly hefty $42,000.
Oh, hell with that.
Yowza. Yeah, but yeah, either one of those.
Golf.
Yeah, but either one of those is a certainly desirable vehicle. I'm more interested in what you have to say about the TDI Sport Wagon.
Yeah, me too.
The TDI wagon is awesome. That's, yeah, there's nothing more you can say. I mean, it handles great, gets great fuel economy, got lots of room inside, got plenty of cargo space in the back. Throw down the back seats if you need to carry something big. I think with the back seats up, I think it has 34 cubic feet behind the back seats. So it's a great little car, and I think we'll be adding one permanently to the garage in the next couple of months.
To the Sam Abula Samid personal.
Yes. And then the A3 is it's a great little car, but in typical German fashion, it starts off with what looks like a relatively reasonable base price, and then you can really rack up the options fast. I think the base price is like 26 or 27 grand.
But that's like with nothing.
This one came out to 42. So it's like the BMW 1 Series. You can rack that one up to almost about 50. And I don't think you can get quite that high with an A3, but It's pretty close. This one's pretty loaded. It's got the panoramic sunroof, all-wheel drive. This one does have a DSG, or S-Tronic, as Audi prefers to call it.
Let's just call it the best automated manual in the business. The transmission is fantastic.
Oh, it is. No doubt about it. Really nothing to complain about. It doesn't exhibit any kind of hesitations or anything. It just pulls away smoothly and goes. And it's a quick little car, and gets decent fuel economy, too.
How much was it? 42?
Almost 42, but like I said, this one's got the S-Line package, so it's got really nice leather interior.
And it looks like
an aluminum trim.
Yeah, it looks like an S model, then. That's a really nice-looking car. It's a nicely turned-out car. I bet it rides really, really well. But for 42 grand, I mean, you could buy two of something else. So
yeah. That's similar money to the VW R32, which is the same platform, except you don't get the high power engine. The 2-liter turbo is no slouch, but for that kind of money, you expect something a little more. But there's certainly a lot of options on this thing that you could easily live without, like the nav system. Instead of paying $2,000 for a factory nav, you can go out and buy an aftermarket one for $200, and lots of other things like that.
All right. Well, this week I'm finishing up the Nissan Altima that we talked about last week, and then I get a let's see, Infiniti G37 on Wednesday. So see, I'm looking forward to that, because that's like the best of what Nissan offers,
right,
versus the Altima, which I can't stand. So
I was going to say, that's like the antidote to the Altima, which you despise.
Hey, you know, I thought maybe I'd get used to it, but I, you know, we talked about it on Campfire today, and the interior gets to me. It seems cheap. It's very gray. I mean, it's like that. It's that charcoal that you see in almost every mid-sized car, but it's just a sea of charcoal with almost little or no change anywhere. And you could, like, as a non-designer, I could almost, like, tape on appliques to make it look better, you know, with just some spare bits that you can, find around the junkyard to make the interior look more appealing. But, and I know some of the people on the Campfire were defending the Altima, so some like it, some don't. I can't stand a CVT. The 2.5's a decent engine. It's good enough. I don't even like the seats. And I'm not the kind of guy that's picky about seats. I don't like the seats on this car.
It's a car that didn't connect with you. You don't like it, and that's cool. When I've had the Altimas, I've had them with the CVTs. I even had the hybrid, but that 2.5 is definitely better with a real manual transmission. And I do hear what you're saying about the sea of plastic. The last one I had was actually the V6, and it had a nice brown and tan interior, which does make a huge difference in making the car feel better. You know, because it's some life there instead of just like gray as far as the eye can see.
Right, and it's weird because I'm starting to get the feeling that I'm, you know, like when you get to a certain age when everything looks too expensive to you because. And it seems like people like get into this mode much later in life. It's like, you know, I remember when I paid 25 cents for a candy bar kind of thing. You know what I mean? And right. When I look at the sticker price of this car, which almost 28 grand, and it's the, you know, it's the four cylinder model. It doesn't have the navigation. It's got the moonroof, but I've never opened it once. And I think 28 grand for that, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And you'd think you would be able to get something more for 28 grand, and it seems like that, like when you talked about the A3, it was the same thing. 42,000 for an A3 just does not compute in my mind. I mean, there's like literally 50 cars I would pick before that thing at 42 grand.
Well, so, everything's getting expensive. I mean, we're getting old and cranky, and hey, you kids, get off my lawn.
It's going to get a lot worse.
Right, it's going to get worse with the new fuel economy standards, so, you know, anywhere between, you know, $500 more and infinity more, so God knows what. All right, let's move on to the big business of the day. First off, we've got the GM Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Obviously, is dominating the news. GM, it was $179 billion in liabilities, put up $85 billion in assets.
82, I think.
Is it 82 billion? It's a huge disparity between the two numbers. The government's going to give them $30 billion. Canadian government over $9 billion more. Dan, you've read up on this pretty extensively. What do you think of the situation so far?
Well, there's going to be people that complain about how it's a socialist move and it's really stupid and, you know, it's the worst thing ever and it spells Armageddon and welcome to the communist government of the United States of America. But the fact of the matter is that doing nothing and letting it fail, if you want to just be a pure free market person, that's going to be just as costly, if not more. So while things look like there may be a chance to pull back on the stick and, you know, climb out of this dive, we should at least try. That's the sense that I get. Maybe I'm just an optimist and a sucker.
Dan, I think anybody who talks about the free market garbage, I mean, if we would have a really true market free market country, then when the banks all hit we wouldn't have anything.
There's never been a true free market in this country or anywhere else for that matter. I mean, markets have always been manipulated by somebody, either the government or by, you know, players in the market themselves. You know, when companies get as big as, you know, the finance companies did and, you know, automakers and oil companies, you know, they manipulate the market. It's not a free market.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's the real crux of the issue is that, in fact, we don't have a purely free market, and we did do this kind of move on other businesses that are far less transparent and don't do anything really direct to consumer like General Motors. The fact is that General Motors builds pretty much the most complex and technologically advanced product that is sold on the market. So, that doesn't. I'm not defending them to the death. I mean, there's been mistakes, and hopefully there's
been plenty of mistakes.
Yeah, I mean,
some of them are just so stupid and malignant that you look at them and you think, how could? And you know what? Pretty much every company has. Like when I look at how Toyota basically took the GM roadmap from 1975 and stole it and did their own version of it, and now they're losing money. It's confounding how stupid that was.
Well,
that
they everybody's said, you know what,
we need a brand new SUV, and we need.
It may seem stupid in retrospect, but you know, if you go back and look at, you know, part of the problem is the auto industry is such a long lead industry. You know, it takes 4 or 5 years to bring a new product to market. You know, even for, you know, so called speedy startups, you know, like Tesla, you know, it took them 5 years before they delivered their first car to a customer from when they started development. So, you know, it's not something that you can just, you know, quickly make changes in direction.
Well, that's true, Sam. But at the same time, you know, we were talking when the Tundra, the new Tundra came out, and Toyota came out with all guns a blazing. I think pretty much all of us echoed the same sentiment that they might be trying to do the GM route, and it might not be a good idea. So even while it was happening, it seemed like a pretty odd idea.
Well, I mean, Toyota has always echoed, in some sense, what General Motors had built, even from the early 50s on. But, I mean, they were doing what everybody else has been doing, is following the money. The thing with Toyota you have to look at and you have to respect is the fact that while they had those things in the pipeline, they were nimble enough as a very large organization to actually put the kibosh on things when it started to turn. And yes, they've lost money, but they're not underwater to the tune of $110 billion. So you still have to respect the management.
Right, it could have
been a lot worse. Yeah.
Right, I mean,
and along the way, they also made a lot of good decisions, too. You know, the development of their hybrid systems, you know, has paid off in spades for the company.
Right.
Which is something that the U.S. automakers definitely lagged behind on.
Right, and it's something that, another thing, Honda doesn't get the credit at all. And Honda was in lockstep on hybrids, I mean, back in the 90s with the Insight. The original Insight.
Well, I think the Insight actually came before the Prius,
Prius came to market in Japan first, but made it to the U.S. about 6 months ahead of the Prius.
The thing with Honda is, and Honda, you know, it's an interesting case because you look at Toyota, and Toyota is like fully in the tank. They were full frame trucks and basically, you know, GM based in Tokyo in that sense. But then you, or wherever Toyota is based, was it Toyota City? I don't want to sound too ignorant.
Aichi,
but you know, Honda builds things, they do things the Honda way. You look even at their pickup truck, the Ridgeline, that's a pure Honda. There's nothing else like it on the market, and it fills the need, and it's clever engineering, it fits with the rest of the ethos that all their vehicles have. But you know, that's the thing where you get back to GM and you look at, okay, so a lot of the mistakes that were made were at the top level. So you know, just executives, bad decisions, no clear vision, recklessness. One of the things that's going to go on is the board is going to be replaced because the way it's going to break down is like Chrysler's bankruptcy has broken down. There's going to be a bad GM and a good GM, and they're going to basically take the bad and liquidate and roll the good stuff into a new General Motors that's going to take over things like the VIBA and whatever good assets there are.
Actually,
and
it's more like the other way around. The VIBA is going to be taking control of the new General Motors.
Okay.
Right.
the VIBA will actually own, I think initially 15 or 17%.
17.5%.
17.5%,
options to buy later on.
Yeah. But they only get one director, and they don't have
and that's good. That's very, very good. And I think everybody recognizes, including the UAW that they should not be running the company because it's not
well,
in their
no,
best
because,
interest to do so.
We've seen that kind of thing before. You know, there needs to be, first of all, there needs to be just good general, you know, management from the top. People that understand cars more maybe than they understand a pure balance sheet, because there's two things going on here. GM has been under the thumb of just straight bean counters, it seems, for long enough. This has been going this way for 40 years, just about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fundamental problem that GM and a lot of other companies, both automotive and otherwise, have had for a long time is that, you know, they had this attitude that, and I think it was actually Alfred Sloan, you know, one of the early leaders at GM.
The 20s, 30s, and 40s,
the original leader at GM, I think.
Basically that, you know, we're not in the business of building cars. We're in the business of making money. Well, you know, the fundamental problem with that is if you don't make good cars and you don't make good product, the money, you're not going to get any money.
Well, Alfred Sloan's other thing.
You've got to have a good product that appeals to customers in order to make that money.
Right.
You need I mean, ultimately, it comes down, you know, as a corporation, as a, you know, fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders, you know, you've got to make money. But the way you do that is by making a good product.
Right.
Right. And a car for every person purpose was the line that Sloan coined.
You know, but not necessarily five cars for every person.
Right. Here's my thought on the subject. This was destined to happen for 50 years. It was as good as written. There is just no way GM could ever survive with the legacy costs that they have. Because let's put put it in perspective. They have 600, Dan, they have 650,000 retirees and 60,000 active workers. Okay,
they could have this off.
Okay, they couldn't have. They could not have, Dan, because here's the thing. When you have the union that won't let you shrink, okay? It costs $100,000 a person to get them to retire, okay? You have to keep volume up, okay? And then as competition...
Well, that's the pickle they ended up in.
Let me finish. Hyundai comes in. Kia comes in. Toyota increases. Honda increases. Everybody's getting bigger. There's more competition. And as competition increases, everybody starts to right-size themselves to be about the same size. But GM, Ford, and Chrysler were not allowed the opportunity by the unions to right-size themselves in a timely manner because, you know what? You do need to be nimble. And Toyota showed it with very deft ability how to be nimble when they turned off the spigot on the Mississippi plant. They rearranged their business so that they didn't have capacity for 10 million products. And just like that, they're within a year of being back to Toyota the Dominator, okay? GM couldn't have done that in a million years. Not in a gazillion, bazillion years could they have done that. Because the fundamental problem is when you have no chance to compete, and then, and, you know, in the unions, their comment is, you know, we're competitive. You can't be competitive in this market. You have to win. And if winning means losing, and when it comes to the union, and I feel for them, and they're in a really tough position because how are you supposed to tell the people that are counting on you that you have to take less money? But the global reality is that the American business was not competitive enough. And you listen to what Fritz Henderson was saying. He says, you know what? The American, you know, what we did, what we had could not be supported any longer. And that's it is what it is. They couldn't compete anymore.
And Fritz, I mean, Fritz totally fell on his sword today. And, you know, it might be nice to see some more of that kind of corporate humility happening. But you can't blame it all entirely on the union. I mean...
No.
We started by
saying the management made a lot of mistakes. And you the Aztecs of the world and the fact that they had so many plants that build SUVs and the cost associated with converting these plants. I mean, they could have at some point said, you know, let's just stick to four truck and SUV plants, and if the market says we want five, then we're just going to have to ignore the market because we know that if this market shifts quickly, we can't turn on a dime.
They couldn't do that, and
it was short term thinking. And you know what? Part of it is these executives are only on board for 4 or 5 years. And you mentioned Alfred P. Sloan; he was around for 20 years as the CEO. He led GM for decades. For decades, 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Let's not get too far off the point that, you know, regardless of what happened in the early stages of GM, I mean, this has been coming for 30 years because of all the things that you just pointed out, Chris. I mean,
50 years.
You can't entirely blame the unions. You can't entirely blame management. You can't entirely blame even customer
desires. There's plenty of blame desires. To go around for everybody.
It's just, I mean, the unions and GM both share some culpability here. I mean, GM agreed to labor negotiations going back to when they said, oh, yeah, we'll give you those plum labor contracts.
And, all I have and to say to
the
that,
business
Dan,
was
is,
totally
is,
different.
Is and 1998.
Well, they had an entirely
$2 million. UAW, quote unquote, showed them who's boss, and they basically what they did was they dug a 6 foot deep hole, and they bought a really nice brass casket.
Buried
and
GM.
They were all in their. No, I'm talking about the union. They were in their late 40s. They spent the money on the casket, which was that $2 billion that GM lost in that strike, and they waited. You know, they put 1 foot in. And then they played video games until it was time to put in both feet and cover the hole. And that's where they're at now. They're looking up in the hole, and people are throwing dirt on them. And you know what?
Well,
that when stuff like that happened, when the GM started to see that this is not working, and that's exactly when it happened. And the same thing, by the way, happened at Ford when Jack Nasser said, "You know what? Long term, we can't compete with Toyota." And he saw it. He decided it was too much work, and he didn't do it. And then he started doing all these crazy management structure things where everybody wanted to be a manager, and then they had all these management classes for everybody that everybody had to take, and they were, you know, rolling out one new car a year for 5 years. It was insanity. And Ford just went through it first. But both companies have been in this situation, and they've known what they needed to do for a long time, but there are a lot of external factors that forced them to stick with the plan. I mean, it wasn't just well, unions, like I said, about the crossover or the SUVs. And then as soon as the SUVs became out of vogue, then, you know, all the effort that we wanted them to put into cars, they immediately threw into crossovers. I mean, look how many crossovers came so fast.
They're in the position, and I think all American brands are in this position, of they have to aggressively and myopically follow the money, because if they try to just be a little more sane about it, there's no way they're gonna make profit. You know, they don't make enough on their cars. I mean, they've got these plants that are not as new as all of the, you know, I mean, Toyota, Hyundai, Honda, the oldest plant that they've got is what, 30 something years old? You know, it was what, Marysville, the Ohio plant for Honda.
Not even that.
You know, it's 86, 85, Kentucky plant in Toyota.
Well, the Honda Marysville plant was the first. I think that was 84 when that opened up.
Yeah, and then, so, and then Kentucky for Toyota followed.
Right. So that. So those plants are way more modern. The way of doing business that those companies use is a different. I mean, you know, we can talk about that till we're blue in the face. That's
right.
The past.
Well, we could sum it up with this: the competition had every advantage in the world, and the domestics had none.
Oh, GM and the domestics gave the competition basically every advantage in the world in a lot of ways.
No, I'm talking about the yen manipulation, the fact that they didn't have the union.
Believe me. There's that, but there's also the fact that, you know, this now that we're seeing this pain, this is just like deferred payment. You know,
this is basically they're cashing in all those.
We're just going to avoid, and if, like you said, Jack Nasser, he didn't do it. You know, it's the same thing. It's just they avoid. Everything is just come home to roost this year, and you know, it does cut both ways. Everybody's in it, you know, up to their eyeballs, and you know what I see is, they're restructuring and they're taking a real. You read through the highlights kind of it, and it seems like they've taken a very realistic view of it. They're pinning it at a 10 million unit break even point, which I think is doable.
At least for the next year or two, might be optimistic.
Yeah, but it leaves room for when an economic rebound does happen with all the product that they've got that's just refreshed.
Yeah, I mean, if the market gets back to 12, 13 million a year, you know, then they can be hopefully consistently profitable.
Right, and then they could look at a shuttered plant that they still own and just say, you know what? It's unmothballed. Let's go. Let's do it.
Yeah, they're going to spin that up if they can. They're going to spin up a new small car and some shuttered plant. I mean, you know, the things, there's certainly unknowns. You know, there's still all this talk of the your great new holy grail of a small fuel-efficient car that apparently we want, yet we haven't bought yet. So, you know, that remains to be seen.
They want big, powerful, fuel-efficient cars.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Americans want. They don't.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't want small, fuel-efficient
cars. No, people don't want small anything. I mean, just like for an example, when I used to go shopping for clothes, I could not find double extra larges because, I mean, I'm a wide guy. I take double X. Could never find them. Now you go to the store, they're everywhere. Everybody has double X.
You can't find mediums.
Everything. You can't get a smaller or medium, right?
Yeah.
So America has grown exponentially within the last 10 years. So, and I mean by
physically
America, I mean
otherwise.
Physically. We have physically as individuals grown by leaps and bounds. Less and less people are going to be interested in the Fiestas as an option. And Sam, you're absolutely right. I want 400 horsepower, 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, and 50 miles per gallon, and GM's holding out on me because they can't give it to me. That's what
they can give it to you.
Because they're controlled by the big oil companies.
Come on now. I mean, GM can give you anything you want. They could give you that car, but it's going to cost you about $300,000. Cheap on the cheap side. So
right. But I think Fisker's doing it for 100, right? So
mean they're going to make money at 100.
Right.
I mean,
there's a big difference between selling it for 100 and making money at it.
Well, we'll see. We'll see on that one. But all right, let's just do a little exercise here. Sam, give me one reason why GM needs to succeed.
Why they need to succeed
in bankruptcy? Why they need to come out as a better company?
Like you said earlier, I think the cost to American society and to taxpayers is likely to be even higher than what it's going to cost to get GM through bankruptcy and get them back on their feet, get the company fixed. Because if you throw another $100,000-$200,000, the cascading effects of GM going under completely would be between GM, suppliers, dealers, and then all the businesses that rely on cash flow from people who work for all those other companies. The cascading effect is going to be huge, in the hundreds of thousands of additional job losses, which means lost tax revenue, means people losing their houses, going into foreclosure. So I think the potential costs of a failure are even bigger than the cost of trying to fix it.
Okay, now, Dan, on a personal John T. consumer level, why is it important to some guy that doesn't even know any better for GM to succeed?
Well, I think that we need to maintain our ability to manufacture something here in the United States. And General Motors is one of the last bastions of a manufacturing base. And, I think that the one thing that maybe John Q. Public cares about is, at this point, buying American. When you see how you go into a Walmart store and there's like nothing made in this country, yet we have brilliant engineers, fantastic tradespeople. Why can't we keep some things within our shores and have some pride in the products that we do make? And I feel proud of GM. Seeing what they've been able to do within the last 3 years, it's been a just a huge effort, and I hope that they can pull it out. If I had money, I'd put it behind GM.
Any company that can build cars like the ZR1, this Cadillac CTS-V, they deserve to live.
Right. And in my opinion, the reason why GM needs to succeed here is for competitiveness. I mean, competition is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And with a General Motors in the mix, everybody is going to be better. Ford is right now doing very good work, but they will have to accelerate. Because if you're looking at the news today, I mean, Ford released a press release saying, we want to make sure everybody's on equal footing. We don't give GM any kind of slam dunk opportunities. No alley-oops for GM, which I think maybe might be too late for that. But because I think just in terms of what Ford has to pay back and what GM already doesn't have to pay back, that there's already a big advantage starting to take place, and GM's getting that foothold. But I mean, think about it in terms of the fuel economy battles. You have another big player that wouldn't otherwise be there if it weren't for this situation. And you know, if you think GM came up with some decent ideas before, wait till you take the shackles off them. Wait till you tell them, hey, you know what, guys? We don't have to consider the fact that our cars cost $3,000 a piece more to build than the competition's. Wait till they are bringing in vehicles from wherever they damn well please, and note that none of the Mexico plants are going anywhere, because that's a huge competitive advantage to GM, and I think they're just going to continue over time to shrink what they're doing in the U.S. because it's not advantageous for them.
Well, the Mexico plants are newer and probably more flexible than anything they've got in the U.S.
The fact that you know, it's probably $10 an hour labor instead of...
That doesn't hurt either.
They did announce a few days ago that they're going to... One of the plants that is planned to be shut down, or at least that's losing a product... we'll get a new product in 2011, which will be a new small car, which will be built here in the U.S.
Right.
So they are planning to add a new small car in the U.S., which is, it looks like that's probably going to be a successor to the Avail, an all-new design.
Hopefully they can't come soon enough.
Hopefully they base it off Corsa, because that would just be sweet.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it'll share the platform with the next generation Corsa, but with a different body style, keeping with the... It looks like from some spy photos that Top turned up the other day, it's got a lot of similar styling elements to the Chevy Spark, which is coming. That one's probably going to be coming to us from China. But
I thought the Spark was coming from Korea.
Korea or China. It could be either one. I'm guessing it might actually be China.
Engineering in Korea, manufacturing in China? With the
I just assume that Daewoo Operations would be building that.
Not necessarily.
They could be building some of them now.
They build a version of the Daewoo Matiz in China, so it could.
Sam has a wealth of knowledge.
The Spark's been spotted testing in China, so I think they're actually. And Fritz Henderson said a few weeks ago that they're going to start importing something, some car from China in the next couple of years. So I'm guessing Spark will come from China, and the Aveo successor will be built here.
Okay, let's go to another part of this. GM has announced that the BBC has announced that Magna has agreed to take the majority stake in Opel from GM. Now, by majority stake, GM...
They mean 20%.
Well, I'm thinking...
That's a funny majority.
More like, is this going to be their... GM's going to have a 35% stake in the brand. The Opel workers will have 10%. I believe the dealers will have a portion of it, and then Magna is going to have...
No, it's not the dealers. It's the Opel employees get 10%, GM keeps 35%, and then this Russian bank, Sberbank, or however you pronounce it, we'll have another 35%, and then Magna gets the other 20%.
Right, but Magna and the Russian company are in cahoots, right? I mean,
basically the Russian bank is putting up most of the money, and Magna will essentially be in control of Opel.
Right, and then they need GM because all the existing platforms that Opel has and future platforms and engines and all that stuff, Magna has none of that, none of the engineering.
So,
and GM's going to make... when someone else is the majority owner and you have the technology, then that means you're guaranteed to make a profit.
Does that turn GM basically into an OEM for Magna? Kind of flipping it around?
Not quite, I don't think.
I think Magna... It'll be more like Magna will be the OEM for GM.
Well, I mean,
they'll build cars for GM to sell.
Yeah, pretty much, right. Right. Then, you're like, by the way, GM, we're going to be using this new steering pump. Sorry. tell your engineers to buzz off. And you know what? They've basically guaranteed themselves some share in Europe. So Magna's a very interesting case. They're a very aggressive supplier in a time where suppliers are like in the middle of air raids and they don't have a cover.
Well, Magna has wanted to be in the car business for years.
And, I mean, this has been Frank Stronach's dream. He was the founder of Magna, and he's the chairman. And over the weekend, he told Toronto newspaper, the Globe and Mail, that he actually wants to start building Opels in Canada as well, which, presumes that, he might be picking up one or more plants from Chrysler and or GM. you know, plants that are, you know, that are like, that are scheduled to be closed here, because, you know, wouldn't really make sense to build an all new plant. So he might end up buying, for example, you know, the Oshawa truck plant, which GM is closing down, and retooling that to build Opals, which would make for an interesting possibility that, you know, maybe he could end up building Opals in Canada and supplying those to a new Saturn owned by, say, Roger Penske.
Now, well, the question Magna been mentioned in the Saturn?
Yeah, Magna was potential. Yeah. But, you know, the question that I have is the same as the question with the automakers. Is where's the money going to come from? Because Magna's been taking a beating, as everybody else has. And maybe they'll be able to turn it around a little faster. Magna is a huge supplier, like you said, and you know they're tied up with, I think they're tied up with what, Steyr in Europe.
Well, yeah, they merged with Steyr about 10 years ago.
Yeah, so you know, as far as OEMs go, they're one of the biggest, if not the biggest, I would suspect. So, I mean, they're a big company and they have tons of expertise. I think Magna Steyr actually
the largest supplier in the world.
Yeah, Magna Steyr actually runs the plant in Graz, Austria, that makes or did make things for BMW. I think it was X3s.
They have been building the X3,
right?
And the next gen X3 is moving
to South Carolina.
South Carolina,
yeah.
But they're going to take over production of the Z4.
Yeah, so
They're also going to be taking over production, extra production of Boxsters from Porsche, which previously had been done in Finland by Valmet. They build Dodge minivans, Chrysler minivans, and Chrysler 300s and Jeep Grand Cherokees
for the European market. So I mean, they're no dummies. When they're not just, you know, coming to this as neophytes, they have a wealth of experience. So if anybody can do it and make the transition from supplier to manufacturer, it's probably them. And this is a common story. I mean, Bendix wanted to do it back in the day. They had their SWC car that never actually got off the ground, but was a pretty fully realized prototype. So it's not an uncommon idea. You know, we'll see if they can kick GM's ass at the Opel game. So,
right. Well, another part of what Magna wants to do with this deal is they want to take the platforms and offer up the platforms to other manufacturers, you know, and build cars for other manufacturers, you know, place the body and replace the top hat, as they call it, you know, on the Opel platforms. Because that's one of the things that, you know, automakers and suppliers have been saying for some time now, that, you know, especially as they move forward, you know, towards electric vehicles, you know, the powertrain distinctions become less and less important, because there really isn't any. Once you get rid of the engines, you know, there's less of a distinction there. So they're relying more on things like styling and interior and features. Magna wants to use Opel as a means to sell platforms to different manufacturers, and just, you know, throw different top hats on them.
Yeah, well, and, you know, platform engineering is not a dirty word if it's done well. I mean, even among a single automaker that uses a platform and leverages a platform to good effect.
Toyota with the Camry. I mean, it's the RX. Yeah. It's the mother of all platform sharing.
It's half of Toyota's lineup.
Right.
Yeah, so
more than half, probably.
Same thing at Honda with the Accord platform. Yeah, the Accord platform is under the Odyssey. It's under the MDX. It's under the
everything.
TL. Yeah.
Everything. I mean, so, you know, that's really interesting, though, sharing a single platform among, you know, so is it going to end up being, you know, various bottom feeders in the market, or is it going to be big brands that are going to pick up Magna's platform, which is essentially GM's platform?
It could well be a combination of the
two.
Yeah,
you know, the Epsilon too, and don't get this wrong, that is not Magna's platform. They are using GM's platform.
And, right. You know, it just goes back to being proud of GM, as we all should. They have some of the best engineering on the planet. That's a great platform. So if you're going to pick one to use, that's not a bad one to go with.
Yeah, and back to the GM thing, I can't wait till this is behind everybody, and then you've got the, oh, by the way, we're no longer shackled GM. It is going to be, I guarantee the competition is going to be very, very, very concerned. And
you're a Detroit fanboy.
Oh, totally. But you know what?
Actually, it kind of sounds like all three of us are tonight.
Right, but the fact is that it's been like the little kid that gets picked on in the movie, and then at the end he learns karate from Mr. Miyagi and kicks somebody's ass. I mean, that's how it is. I mean, it's the classic Adam Sandler tale, where, you know, happy ending and everything. So
I think you're thinking of Ralph Macchio. But,
no, I use two different types of movies, actually. Yeah. Dork.
We've had enough doom and gloom. We've had enough people, showing off their finely tuned senses of schadenfreude about GM's troubles. And, this is one of the hugest companies in our country. It's a giant bankruptcy. It's, I think it's the third largest or
fourth largest.
Yeah, it's up there with like Enron and stuff. Look, we could be negative or we can look at what's going to happen and we can be optimistic. And, you know, this is not the worst thing that's ever befallen our country. It's a challenge. And, one hopes that we're capable of rising to challenges with all the talk about how everybody's a winner. I mean, you get a trophy for showing up to Little League, for crying out loud. So let's actually just do something and see where it goes. So that's why I'm optimistic. I mean, the alternative is no good, so we might as well try.
All right, let's go on to the next piece of business. Volvo announces a diesel plug-in hybrid for 2012. Wow, that's a long way away, first of all, and then it's kind of cool because it's all things that we've asked for. We've asked for, a diesel hybrid because that makes sense. But where do you see this going, Sam?
I don't know. It depends. You know, if they sell off, if Ford sells off Volvo like they're trying to.
Begging to, yeah, they'd love to.
Yeah. And anybody who will take it off their hands, basically. It'll be interesting to see if they can afford to do it. I don't know. A diesel you got all the worst of all worlds there. You've got the additional cost of a diesel, the additional cost of hybrid, and then the additional cost of a plug-in. So this isn't going to be a cheap vehicle.
Volvos are not inexpensive to begin with.
This is going to be a really expensive one. Volvo.
The diesel is it their D5? Do we know? I mean, because they've already got a diesel. So
Could be a D5 or it could be a. I would guess if they're going to do a plug-in hybrid, they'll probably switch to a four-cylinder for this one.
Okay, so I think actually they do have a D4 over in some markets, and they have neither here.
Yeah, they do in like the S40 and C30.
Yeah.
For now at least, they still have access to the Ford engine line, and Ford's got four-cylinder diesels over there. I mean, they're all common engines between Ford of Europe and Volvo.
It's kind of I'm reading up on it now, and it says that it'll use 71% of its 11.3 kilowatt hour pack of lithium ion batteries to power the back wheels for 30 miles. And after that, the diesel engine takes over and drives the front wheels.
So it's okay, kind of
so they're doing a through the road, what's called a through the road hybrid.
It's a cheap way to build a hybrid because you don't need the fancy torque split device or whatever the fancy CVT that Toyota uses.
That's what Peugeot's doing as well. Peugeot's building a diesel hybrid this way. They showed four different concepts last year in Paris. And they've announced that their first production one coming in 2011, based on their new crossover, the 3008 crossover. And it's the same arrangement where they've got an electric motor driving the rear wheels and the diesel engine driving the front wheels. So it's called a through-the-road hybrid.
It's clever because they've already got a lot of the engineering taken care of. It's basically I'd expect to see a XC70 rear axle under that with an electric motor fitted to it. They've already got the diesel and the front-wheel drive powertrain. So it's using a lot of pieces that they already have, and basically you're adding a battery pack and an electric motor and control software. A bunch more ECU.
The controls to manage all of it is still pretty complex. Actually, very complex.
Yeah, sure it is, but you don't have to.
Expensive.
Yeah, exactly, but you don't have to put a lot more.
It takes out a significant piece of hardware, but it's by no means the most expensive part of this.
Oh, no, absolutely not, but it's clever, and I like that.
Yeah. No, I have no issue with through-the-road hybrids. They actually work quite well.
Now, you know, I think this goes back to what we were talking about with competition earlier, because look at the way the European nations are tackling the issue.
European nation, nice slip.
Yeah. The European nations are tackling the issue of hybrids. They're doing it in a completely different manner. And then you look at what the United States is doing, and specifically General Motors with the Volt, three completely different solutions to the same thing. I mean, it's going to be, one of these technologies is going to be better than the other ones. And just because Toyota was first doesn't mean that they were, or I'm sorry, Japan was first with their hybrid solution, doesn't mean they're going to be best. So it'll make Toyota better, it'll make Honda better, and it'll make their hybrids better. I mean, and it'll make GM work hard, and it'll make Ford work hard, and then the Peugeots of the world, I mean, that don't even touch the soil here, are going to drive what happens in different countries.
Yeah, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, because actually I would argue that hybrids have been around a much longer time than anybody really thinks. These were things that GM was playing with back in the 60s, and they were applying things. They bought EMD, which made heavy locomotives back in the day, and applied some of those diesel electric ideas to automotive prototypes, and ended up with hybrids back in like 69 70. Ford had a city car that was all electric back around that same time. So
GM had electric cars, and that, you know, they had electric Corvairs that they were testing back in the 1960s as well. And you know, even, you know, the Toyota hybrid system, you know, the power split parallel hybrid that Toyota uses wasn't invented by Toyota. It was invented by some engineers from TRW in 1969 1970. You can go back and find the patents. You know, the patents were granted in 1970, and that's what Toyota based their work on, was the, you know, the stuff developed by these guys from TRW in the late 60s and early 70s. That, you know, they were the first ones to come up with this concept of the power split hybrid that Toyota uses.
So it just really speaks to using engineering chops to cleverly solve a problem. And so we're going to see a lot of different solutions. And like you said, Chris, not one is going to necessarily emerge as the best, or the most popular not be the best. So
yeah, and there isn't necessarily one solution for every problem, you know, that fixes every problem. You know, for different applications, there's going to be different solutions. You know, for some applications, you know, just a straight-up diesel engine is better. You know, for some applications, a hybrid is better. For some applications, hydrogen is better. So there's going to be a lot of different solutions.
And like Dan, you just touched on it. And just because you have the best solution doesn't mean it's going to be the one that wins. I mean, you remember, you probably don't remember this because it was before any of our times, but Edison was pushing DC power, and he was he was electrocuting elephants.
With AC.
Yeah, with AC. Yeah. I mean, it was insanity. And then look at Beta versus VHS. VHS won, and it was bigger, uglier, worse.
Oh, VHS won because Sony refused to license its technology. You know, it's the same thing as...
They refused to license its technology to one particular segment of the entertainment industry.
Well, no, they refused. VHS got so popular because
Sam's talking about the porn industry. They didn't want to give. They didn't want to give the keys. And you know what? If you don't do for porn, the porn won't do for you.
Porn went, went for VHS, and that was all she wrote.
You know, those guys are innovators. I wish our videos streamed as anyway. yeah,
the podcast brought to you by Vivid.
It goes back to, you know, again, like you said, the best, you know, DC was certainly not the best. DC would have required a generation station every mile or so, and AC can actually be transmitted.
Right, but you know, Edison was thinking about controlling all the generation stations, and he was going to make billions, he was a great idea.
Right, exactly. But, yeah, not really a good idea. It'll take a while for all this new technology to sort of settle out. It's got that Wild West feel. To a certain degree, when we're thinking about really a paradigm shift in propulsion systems. So I'd say the more the merrier, you know, be as creative as you want engineering-wise, and, you know, let's see what works.
Right.
I'm in a happy mood tonight.
It's very, very unique and weird. You know, and it's amazing to me that this technology is not new technology, and it's anything but, and like the compression the HCCI stuff you were doing at GM, Sam, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I mean, they were GM was working on compression ignition, what, 80s, early 80s, 1981?
Early 80s is when they started to work
cylinder on it. Deactivation, yeah. Same thing.
Yeah, automakers have been working on that ever since, yeah.
Well, cylinder deactivation.
I was around when the first cylinder deactivation system, you know, went into production.
Do you like that V864?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, the thing that we're seeing now is the cost of all this stuff that is not new ideas. It's newly inexpensive, and it's still expensive, but we've actually got computers that are fast enough to do it.
Right.
Now.
Well, you could get cheap modules that will control the motion. I mean, basically, the compression ignition was a non-starter in 1981 because, you know, what were they using? Uh-huh. Mechanicals? I mean, how is that going to happen? I mean, it was.
Yeah, they may have had some microprocessor control, but nowhere near the power that we've got now.
But it's
now,
more like a macro processor. I think the most telling thing is the Apollo 11 had less capacity than a floppy. So, I mean...
Apollo 11 had less computing power than your typical calculator. Pocket calculator
from the 70s. I mean, think about that. That's how far we've come in 40-some years. So, 40 years, exactly. So, I mean, and Sam's talking about hybrid technology in 1970. It probably wasn't going to happen for 20 more years. And as it turned out, it took a little more than that. So...
But you know what?
The first hybrid was created by Ferdinand Porsche back at the turn of the 19th or the turn of the 20th century. Lorner Porsche.
He did everything. I mean, you know what? He did.
He was a genius.
It goes back to none of this stuff is a revolutionary idea in the sense that it hasn't been thought of yet. We're going to see a lot
just
of
whether you can actually make it work.
Right, we're going to see a lot of it work. And you know what? I think that going forward, we should look at this as being in essence a new kind of Apollo program. You know, the only reason why that program succeeded was because the country was behind it.
Right,
and it was a huge
and it was competition,
huge
and
money
was the competition that that really made that happen. And as soon as Russia lost the competition, they canceled their moon program. I mean, it was never going to happen. They have never touched the moon. Nobody's touched the moon.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, Russia has amortized their program. I mean, we're still using Soyuz capsules and stuff. I mean, it's just if you're going to do something, you might as well commit to it. And whether or not it's 100% the business case can be made for it, sometimes you just got to do it. So
they never found cheese on the moon, or else we'd be there right now. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Last thing before we get into the couple podcast emails. Fiat confirms the 500 at Chrysler dealers in 18 months. Other new models to be U.S.-specific products. And the gist of this one is that just because a vehicle is going to be a Chrysler-badged Fiat doesn't mean that it's going to be just going to look like a Punto or whatever. It's going to have its own sheet metal. It's going to have its own, like Sam said earlier, its own top hat. It's going to have, you know, American design, American engineering involved, but it's going to be sitting on Fiat platforms, and sometimes it's going to be Fiat engines, sometimes it's not, and it's all going to start with the Fiat 500, which I suspect is going to be the only one that's going to be badge engineered. What do you think?
Well, what do you think about the 500 in general? Because I would predict that there's going to be a pretty sharp spike when it first goes on sale of interest in sales, and then it'll quickly taper off to something possibly less than Mini.
Unless they bring over several variants like the Cabrio, the Abarth. Yeah, if they bring over the Fiat 500 Abarth, that could be some serious
right.
Fun.
But you know what? I think you're onto something there, Dan. Because a lot of these little niche vehicles,
it's going to be a niche product.
They flatline after about not flatline. I shouldn't say that. They really level off after about 18 months. And it's just like when the Beetle, the new Beetle came out, or the PT Cruiser out, or the Smart came out. All these vehicles had a big bang, and then there was a big downhill plunge after that. If Chrysler can get very clever with the marketing like Mini has. I mean, Mini is a very clever company. There's a lot of really smart marketing people that are out. They're doing their jobs even better than the engineers are doing theirs. Put it that way, because they've got their own little subculture going on over there at Mini. And if Chrysler can even come close to repeating that with this car, they're going to be onto something.
Well, if they do it right, they're going to use the 500 and different versions of the 500 as a draw to the dealership. So once they've got the interest built and they've got it pulling people in, they're going to have something else besides the Sebring and Avenger and the minivans.
Anything else, I mean?
Anything. Yeah, pretty much. Because, you know, so I can see it as like the traffic draw to get people in the door. But it may not necessarily be the vehicle that they end up selling the bulk of. So they're going to need to back the Fiat 500 up with something pretty quickly, something that's a lot more mainstream.
Right, and we don't even really know what's in the Fiat pipeline right now because, A, we don't really train our eyes on Fiat very much because they're not really in the USI, and Sam's probably as smart about this subject as anyone just because of the fact that he's Sam. Samness would probably give him some insight on this, but I mean, I don't really have a clue what they've got coming out in the next 18 months. I mean, they could be doing joint projects since last year with Chrysler engineers for all we know. I mean, we really have no clue.
Yeah, they're certainly working on, restyled vehicles based on Fiat platforms. Yeah, certainly. I'm sure for the last 6 months they've been working on it, at least putting new bodies onto the Fiat platforms, to replace the Sebring and the Avenger and the Caliber as quickly as possible.
There you have it. All right, let's go to a couple questions that we've gotten. And thanks again for all the questions. podcast@autoblog.com. If you're interested in putting in a question, and this one is from John in St. Louis, Missouri. His question is. You guys do a great job of picking out a bunch of cars for listeners, readers who want XXYYYZ money. Where most people keep their price range within the amounts of a normal Joe can afford. So let's think outside the box. I'm interested to know what cars you would want in the $100,000 to $200,000 price range, the $200,000 to $500,000 price range, and the $1 million mega super exotic price range. Feel free to be creative. It doesn't have to be a new car. It could be an old classic, but at auction, sedan, sports car, you name it. Just curious. Keep up the good work. Appreciate it, John. And he came up with his three, so I'm not going to use his three just yet. But, okay, Dan. Oh, I shouldn't have done this.
For the 100 to 200,000, I'd go with a nice top-of-the-line Range Rover. With the supercharged engine and just all filled out. And
he always preaches about reliability and serviceability, and then he picks the worst.
You know, yeah, reliability may not be tops, but boy, are they fun. For the 1 million, the top category, I'd go with a Miura. It's a Miura. You know, I'd want it to be the perfect Miura, but they're beautiful. They are, even the chassis is just beautiful to look at. So, yeah, the Miura would be, that's one of the cars that I've gazed at since I was a kid and just been like, oh. That middle one I'm just having trouble with.
I'll go next. My 200 to 500,000 was the Panamera, that's the Aston, right?
No.
The Rapid. I would never pick the Panamera.
Oh, the Rapide. Yeah.
The Rapide. Would be my 200 to 500,000, and interestingly enough, my 100 to 200,000 would be the V12 Vantage, which I'm assuming is going to be between 100 and 200,000. I think it's in there.
And it's going to be pushing the upper end of that.
I think my number three option, I would take one car that was like a number one model production ZR1, that would be like something like that, because I don't want a Veyron. I have no interest in new vehicles that cost over $1 million. The Reventon is pretty cool, but no thanks. It's beyond my ability to comprehend price wise for a car. I guess I would have to just tap out on that one. Sam, what about you?
All right, the $100,000 bracket. Definitely, I would take a ZR1. and install a proper set of Recaro seats.
You can throw the seats out in the dark in the dumpster.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, on the CTS-V, the Recaro seats are a $3,400 option. You know, and it's worth every penny. If they offered that, you know, that option on the Corvette, it'd be perfect. See, $200,000 to $500,000. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cars in that segment. You know, hard to pick just one. Let me come back to that one. And the $1 million plus, I think I would go with the Aston Martin 177. You know, it's not, you know, I don't think the body is, at least the front end, is, you know, the most beautiful of Aston's, to say the least. But, you know, just the engineering under it, you know, when I saw that chassis at the Geneva Motor Show, you know, it's like, oh, I would love to have that car. So I would definitely take the 177 in there. You know, I've always been a fan of Ferraris, so I think in the 200 to 500 range, I'd probably go for an F430 Scuderia Spider.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
All right, let's go with John's option. John picked the Carrera GT in the number two slot. I picked the Veyron number three, just because of the performance and engineering. He hated to do it, though, because it was kind of like the cliche choice. And then the number one choice would be the F430, but he's hoping for the F450 replacement. You're going to be kicking that $200,000 in the teeth right there. So,
yeah, absolutely. Because it's, you know, you're already at about $190,000, I think, for an F430. There is one other car that, you know, I would potentially take aside from the 177 in the $1 million class, and that's a McLaren F1. If I could get an F1, you know, it'd be either the F1 or the 177.
All right, we got another question. The next one is, hey, I love the podcast. Respect your opinion on cars. Ha ha ha. I was wondering what year and model of Corvette you would recommend for me. I live in wonderful Wisconsin and currently drive a 350Z year-round. I love the Z for its handling and dependability, and he has about $30,000, maybe a little bit more, to spend on a Corvette. Was wondering what you would recommend. I can always finance the new Corvette, but was curious of your thoughts. Where is the price tag worth it as opposed to an older model? I was wondering if you knew which years were the problem years for the Vet. I was hoping to get a 97, i.e. the problem model. Thank you for your time. And his name is Blake Swan. Okay. Yeah, the 97 model, the first year of the C5 Corvette, I don't know, would be a good idea. So, Sam, what do you think?
Well, just looking up real quick to see what the going rate is for a used Vet, because I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure if there really is a, you know, particularly bad year for a Vet. I was, you know, never, you know, a real huge fan of the styling of the C5s. I always thought they had kind of a big butt look.
Agreed.
But, you know, I think they're all pretty, you know, pretty decent. So if, you know, if you can find one in the price segment, just, you know, one comment, you know, I'm shocked that somebody would be driving a Z year round in Wisconsin. I mean, you know, Wisconsin's a place that actually gets,
maybe he's a blogger and he just goes to Subway and back.
Well, it could be, yeah, or, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, if you put a proper set of snow tires on there, it might be manageable. Just looking at this other site here, you know, list 97 Vet coupe for $12,000. So yeah, I mean, you could probably get, you know, I would be more inclined to go for a C6, you know, an early C6, because I think that might be a better option. I think that would probably fit into that $30,000. It was $30,000,
right? It's $30,000 plus. Yeah, I mean.
You can get a C6 for 30.
You look at a 2006 model, you can get a Z06 for 44 with 16,000 miles on.
You don't want the Z06.
Okay? I'm saying you can get one. I'm not saying he should get one.
I mean, he's asking what we should.
Don't put words in my
mouth, though. I mean,
all right. There's. I mean, I'm looking up and down the list, and I think most of them are in the $25,000 to $35,000 range. I mean, there's one right here. It's a 3LT, which is the top. Top model. It's got a convertible, navigation, heated seats, 25,000 miles, 35 or best offer. Probably can get it from the guy for 32.
Yeah. But, you know, base price on an 06 C6 coupe, $28,000. So, Yeah, that's the going rate for.
And the C6 is really. That's the one to buy. If you're gonna buy, if you're gonna spend $30,000 on a vet,
it's a far better car.
And the C5's not a bad car, but the C6 is just that much better again. So
it's 9 inches shorter. That's why I love it, because the other one looked way too big and wedgy. And
the C6 is just beautiful.
Yeah.
The C5 is kind of like the 84 Corvette.
It's the best Corvette since the C2.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Although I really like the C3s, the Stingrays.
Yeah, the C3s, just they have that beauty going on, that Bill Mitchell style.
The early ones, the small early ones, the big boaty ones, not so much.
Yeah, once they started adding the big spoiler on the back and everything, it got a little ridiculous.
Okay, we're going to get one more question in on the week, and this one's from Andrew, and he says, "Hey guys, love the podcast. Keep up the good work," and we will. "We are looking to get a new car in the summer to replace the 2002 Dodge Stratus. I drive a Dodge Stratus. We are looking at crossovers, and probably our favorite would be the Acura RDX, which I hate, or next best is the Edge. They are probably going to," he said probably, "going to be used with like 12,000 miles on them or a demo. We would like to know what you think and what a good choice for a crossover for $20,000 to $30,000. All-wheel drive is not a necessity, but it's nice. Thanks much." Okay, Danny, you're going to pick the Edge, but why do you pick the Edge?
Well, because we're actually in the market for an Edge, and so I know a little bit about what they're going for, and you could get a really nice Edge Limited with about 20,000 miles on it for between $22,500 and $25,000. You know, certain dealers may put a little bit more on their sticker, but you can beat them down on it. The RDX... I'm sure it drives really nicely. I've never actually had the opportunity to try one. I'm a lot less enthusiastic about having a turbocharged vehicle. The RDX is the turbocharged. I'm not terribly enthusiastic about that anymore. Having two turbocharged vehicles in the driveway, and you know, I've had turbo cars for at least 10 years now, in one form or another. They're thirsty on the whole as a general powertrain. They're not as efficient as you might think, and they're another level of maintenance, which I don't personally want anymore. I don't like the fact that, you know, we took it in and your turbo return seal is leaking and that's going to cost another couple $100, and it just ends up costing money. And then if you hang on to it for any period of time, you're potentially looking at a turbo replacement, either because you used crappy oil and didn't change it, so you end up with nice chunks of coal in the bearings, or the turbo seals die and send oil throughout your entire intake. They're not my thing anymore. The Edge is going to be inexpensive to buy. It's a very nice vehicle. It's going to be inexpensive to keep running in service, I think. And you're going to get more for your dollar. Obviously, the resale is going to drop like a stone, so you have to be committed to it. You know, just long term. But the Edge is, you know, I'm behind that one. So.
All right, now I'm looking on eBay Motors, and I'm seeing a lot of buy it now is for the Limiteds with all-wheel drive with about 15,000, 20,000 miles in the $25,000 range.
Really? So, that's a better deal than we're finding out here. So.
Right. I mean, well, you're probably only looking at the dealers, and you've got to knock like $4,000 off what the dealers are asking and then work from there. I mean, what I do is honestly, here's a tip, and this has worked for me twice. Send somebody else into the dealership, ask them what the price of the car is, then go in yourself and talk to a different salesman and see what they say. If it's on the used car lot, you're going to get two different prices. Pick the better price and then work from there.
I actually like the RDX. I like driving the RDX. You're right. It's not the most efficient car on the road. You know, I think when I had one, I averaged about 21 miles per gallon with it. But it, you know, drove really well. Another one that you might want to consider as an alternative that you probably get actually a really good deal on is the Saturn View. You know, the second gen Saturn View is actually
The second gen, because the first gen sucked.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want the plastic bodied first gen one, but the second gen one, you know, is a solid vehicle. It's got good driving dynamics. Gets you know, decent fuel economy. It's as roomy as certainly as roomy as the RDX.
No, maybe the not Edge is much bigger than the V, the I think.
Yeah, the Edge is definitely a bigger vehicle. But I mean, if you're, you know, if you're contemplating the RDX, you know, the View's in the same size class as that. So it's definitely something you might want.
Yeah, the View is a great vehicle, and we were initially looking at the View until I tried an Edge and was just, you know, that the size difference.
Oh my God, the price on these! You're right, Sam, these are so cheap.
The Views?
You can probably get a View for what, about 15 grand now?
Check this out.
You
can get a View Redline, 17,000 miles on it.
12.5.
No, $20,000.
That's about 10 grand off.
That's pretty good.
It's got everything on. I mean, it is everything. And the Redline does look better than the other model. I mean, I like the lower aggressive front fascia. This is a good-looking car. I mean, it looked really good. And this thing's got everything. It's got it's blue. It's
none of them are going to get really stellar mileage. I mean, the Edge isn't rated great, even with two-wheel drive. Its city number is in the teens. I think it's like 16.
Nice seats.
The View is going to probably rate a little better, but
it's about the same.
Is it? Yeah, it's
heavy.
It's heavy. Yeah, they're all heavy.
They didn't use a lot of high strength steel in the View.
Yes, but they used a lot of steel.
right, but they corrected that with the Equinox, which to me in that price range, the Equinox rocks. So
I
haven't driven it yet. Just based on stats and looks.
I'm gonna be driving
stats
one next
and looks.
Week.
Are you getting one for the week? Or are you getting one for a drive?
No, they're doing the media.
I'm very interested to see what you have to say about that, because that car looks very appealing to me. I like the interior. I like the stats. I like the fact that you can get a four cylinder model that actually has some grunt to it. It seems like a great idea for a crossover that hasn't happened yet for God knows what reason. So.
But I think
this Redline is awesome at 20 grand. I mean, it looks fantastic.
Yeah, I think though, like if you're approaching anything from a driver perspective, the RDX is going to be the winner among that trio. I have
absolutely with the super handling all wheel drive. You know, I mean, when you start pushing that thing through corners,
and
one at 30 grand is going to be an issue anyway.
Well, but it's not like the Edge is a bad handling vehicle, and I don't know that the View it is any worse either. You know, they're dynamically pretty good.
I'd say the View and the Edge are pretty comparable. And
neither one are great.
Dynamics. No, they're not great, but they're competent. But I think that you know, as a pure driver's vehicle. Which is a little bit antithetical to the idea of a crossover, but that the Acura is going to kill them. If
what
that's
about
what
the
you're
CX-7?
Looking
for.
Yeah. CX-7 is I mean, it's got zoom CX, zoom and it's got the same kind of stats.
Yeah. Well, the CX-7's a little bit smaller than the Edge,
but it's comparable to the RDX.
Yeah, you know, closer in size to the View and the RDX. Yeah. So depending on what he's looking for. You know, that's another alternative to consider. You know, it's good looking.
You get a new
vehicle.
One for crying. You get a 2010 model for that 20 to 30.
Yeah. I think the difference between that and the Acura is the Acura is going to feel more deluxe. But then again, it's a premium nameplate, so it better.
Okay, here's a little wrench in the plans here. What about the Lincoln MKX? Because in that price range, you could get one with about 15,000 miles on it for 30 grand.
I really like the MKX. If you're looking for sport, no. If you're looking for a nice design and a very well-turned-out vehicle, definitely check it out.
Yep. There you have it. I'm hungry, guys.
All right. Time to say goodnight.
Yes, it is. All right, take care, guys. We'll see you next week.
All right, podcast@autoblog.com.